2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 372, Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. Panelists Ken Driggs, Mary Ann Watson, Ann Wild, and Mary P. Batchelor.
And what I'd like to do is, I have a couple of introductory comments I want to make, and then I'm going to turn it over. Mary's going to go first. We're going to try to allow as much time as possible for question and answers. And because of the taping situation and because we did it this way once before, it's sort of modeled after the National Press Club, what I'd like to do about questions is I have some index cards, and as soon as I sit down, I'm going to pass them out and along with some pens. And if you have some questions that occur to you, scribble them out on the index cards, and I'll collect them. And we're going to try to group them by topically and so on. And
can I suggest, since it's just such a small crowd, that maybe we dispense with that unless by the end of the session it gets to be too big?
Okay.
And I think I know most of the people here. So.
All right. Well, that's fine
okay.
with me if that's okay with y'all.
Yeah.
We just need to be sure that we get those questions on the microphone off of the taping system. I had two sets of kind of opening comments I'd like to make sort of laying the table for this. One, I'm a criminal lawyer, and I have a graduate law degree in legal history. And I've been applying both of those backgrounds to some writing and research about fundamentalist Mormons for some time. I'm slowly working on a book about them now. And I'd like to make a couple of comments. I think from the outside, the public frequently misses the fact that fundamentalist Mormonism is not a monolithic world. There are lots of different communities, groups in fundamentalism, a couple of larger ones, a lot of smaller ones. There are a lot of people who consider themselves independents, which means they are not affiliated with one or another group. And I have found not a small number of people who sort of have one foot in the church and one foot in fundamentalism. They kind of have allegiances in both. And I think the public sometimes sees some event like some of the things you may have read about the Tom Green trial or some other things, and I think the press contributes to this actually sometimes, and don't always distinguish the groups. I think if you see conduct or situations or beliefs with one part of fundamentalist Mormonism, you can't attribute that to the whole community. You need to recognize that there are different groups. So I believe all three of our speakers actually come from a somewhat different place on the spectrum of fundamentalist Mormonism. And the other question I get all the time is it legal or not legal? And that question comes up obviously with Tom Green's recent conviction. The question is a sort of a resounding maybe, probably not. What you would prosecute fundamentalist Mormons for in polygamous relationships principally is bigamy, the crime of bigamy. It's an old crime that has a pretty well-settled definition in most criminal statutes. And bigamy is essentially a crime of fraud. The spouses don't know about each other. Wife number one or husband number one doesn't know about husband or wife number two. There's a deception that goes on there. And as bigamy is understood in most cases, most states for purposes of prosecution, you've also involved the state in this fraud in that you are getting a marriage license, you're jumping through the hoops that create a legal relationship, and when you go down for that second license, when you fill out the paperwork, you represent that you are eligible to enter into this subsequent relationship, when in fact, if you still have a pre-existing marriage that the law recognizes, you may not. Now, the reality for most fundamentalist Mormons is that they do not involve the state in their relationships. The ones that that I have gotten to know pretty well generally are going to a religious leader whom they recognize to have the authority to solemnize this marriage, and it is solemnized. They recognize it in their communities, but it is not recognized by the law. Their legal standing is essentially the same as a couple of students at the university who decide to share living quarters. They're unmarried people living together. And sometimes people will get divorces or whatever, but their legal status is generally not the kind of status that is prosecuted under bigamy statutes. Well, the alternatives you then have for prosecution is perhaps a fornication statute or an adultery statute. Utah has both of those kinds of statutes. And essentially that's the crime of sexual intercourse outside of a context that the law wants to permit. The problem you run into there is if you're going to prosecute those crimes, the equal protection guarantees of the Constitution require that you prosecute all similarly situated conduct in the same way. You cannot target fundamentalist Mormons and prosecute them and ignore other people engaging in the same conduct and not prosecute them. So most criminal lawyers would tell you, no, this is not really a prosecutable offense. So the question comes up, well, what happened to Tom Green? Now, I was not intimately involved with Tom Green's trial. I knew some about it from secondhand. My impression is that the trial judge there was asked to enter an order by the prosecutor effectively declaring him married for purposes of Utah law. Utah generally does not recognize what we call common law. Common law is where people set up a marital relationship, hold themselves out to the world as married, and declare themselves married without necessarily getting the marriage license. Utah doesn't recognize that. Most states no longer recognize it. But in effect, the trial judge agreed with the prosecution's position that he, in effect, had entered into common law marriages, and he entered an order, as I understand it, essentially declaring him married. I don't know exactly what the jury charged the jury got when they were delivering on the verdict, but it sounds to me like they were told, you will find he is married based on this pretrial order by the judge. Now, if his lawyers have adequately preserved that issue on appeal, I think that conviction is extremely suspect if he does, in fact, challenge that on appeal. As I said, I'm just sort of looking at Green's situation from a distance, but that's my understanding of what had happened. And frankly, I would expect the bigamy aspects of his convictions to be overturned on appeal if he's well represented. With that, I think I'm going to sit down and turn it over to Mary, and I'll be glad to handle any legal questions that may come up in the course of this, but mostly I'm carrying the water for the three authors, so I'm going to sit down and shut up. Thank you very much.
Was this your water pen?
Nope.
I can see a lot of familiar faces, so a lot of you know me. For those of you who don't, my name is Mary Batchelor, and I'm one of the three authors of Voices in Harmony. One of the interesting things about the title of our book is that we added a clause afterward that said, contemporary women celebrate plural marriage. The reason we chose that as part of our title is because we really mean it. These women celebrate their lifestyle. They enjoy it. They appreciate it. They love it, even though it's challenging and difficult at times. And sometimes, in unfortunate circumstances, some of the marriages break down, and as do some marriages in monogamy. And those are unfortunate circumstances, but oftentimes women who are involved in a plural marriage that breaks down go back into a plural marriage because they believe so strongly in this way of life. My specialty in the book was law, but as eloquently as it was already delivered by Ken, I'm going to discuss today the circumstances at the Capitol building in February when a historical event took place there this year. There was several bills that went through the session this year that dealt with marriage, and they specifically dealt with the commitment ceremonies or the legal ceremonies that dealt with marriage. Utah has some very confusing laws. Ken already addressed the bigamy statute and the fact that it's written in such a vague way as to try and encompass someone who isn't, you know, where there isn't a situation where you have two legal licenses, as well as a cohabitation statute. But there is also a law that many people aren't aware of on the books. It's been there since 1953, that makes the officiator of a ceremony that is not legal or that is a void ceremony guilty of a felony crime if he performs a ceremony for somebody that where the marriage is considered void. That would be a homosexual relationship or a polygamous relationship. There's actually a list in statute. Incestuous relationships would also fit into that category. So anyone who officiates for such a marriage would be found guilty of a felony. The interesting thing here is since the law defines that as void, then technically it's not a marriage because it's void. And if it's just a relationship between two people and they're not getting a civil license, then we've got a conundrum. We've got a complexity in the law, which is just very difficult for people to detangle. One of the bills that they were trying to pass in February dealt with exactly this law. When I read through the bill and I studied out the law, I was surprised to find that there already was a law and that the bill didn't really modify the law very much. It just addressed the law. I was kind of confused at that. I thought, why are they passing a bill where they're not really changing the law too much? After studying it out thoroughly and speaking with several constitutional lawyers and getting their advice, I came to the conclusion that there were two changes that they wanted to make in current law. They applied to several different statutes. The first change they were trying to make was to add a penalty for any parent who consented to what they called a prohibited marriage. That would be a homosexual or polygamous relationship. They didn't make it clear whether or not this was supposed to be an attempt at a legal marriage with marriage licenses or just a commitment marriage. In the wording of the parental consent penalty portion of that section, they used some language that was very, to my mind, infringed upon the rights of parents to teach their children their religious beliefs. We also, the American Civil Liberties Union also agreed with us with this interpretation, contrary to the opinion given to us by the author of this bill and sponsor of the bill, who was Senator Ron Allen. He denied that that was his intent to deprive parents the right to teach their children polygamy, but it was very clear to me and to the ACLU that that could very well be the impact of this bill. Some of the wording of that was a phrase that said, any parent who consents, encourages, promotes, or allows a minor to enter into a marriage prohibited by law. The words consents, encourage, promotes, or allows could be construed to include teaching, because if you are promoting a religious belief, you may not be encouraging your child or your minor to enter into marriage while they're still a minor, but it could be construed at a later date by a prosecutor to be that way. When a law is passed, generally the interpreters of that law are not the legislators who pass the law. It falls onto the role of the Attorney General's office and county prosecutors, and they can interpret as broadly or narrowly as they decide. They may decide that they're going to interpret it very narrowly when they pass the law, but 3 years later, they'll interpret it very broadly if it suits them. So we decided it was important to, in fact, lobby. Last summer, I had the opportunity to go through Kids Count Advocacy Academy, which taught me how to lobby. And so when the bill came up, I was fully prepared to lobby, having had this experience. It was sponsored by Utah Children, a powerful advocacy agency in Utah for children's rights and the protection of children in those issues. We decided to focus our attention on this particular bill and on that wording and that particular language. Interestingly enough, because of the salaciousness of the polygamy topic, we knew that we had to be very careful, that we were going to be roasted, so to speak, in the media if we weren't careful. One of the things we had to make very, very clear from the offset is that we do not agree with underage marriages. That came as a surprise to a lot of people, both legislators as well as many in the press. They obviously have, you know, seen the stereotypes, and they say, well, gosh, all polygamists marry 13, 14, 15-year-old girls, which is not true. Large number of polygamists do not believe in underage marriages, and the women who came to lobby with us and who are involved in our book predominantly do not agree with underage marriages. So we made that very clear from the offset. We wrote a letter that we sent to the legislature, and we also distributed it when we lobbied. The first day, we had 11 women. And when we walked into the Capitol building, it was very interesting. We passed Rod Decker of Channel 2 News, and he smiled and walked on, didn't think anything of it. Now, he had already interviewed me for my book, so he knew who I was. A few minutes later, after he kind of had occasion to count that there were 11 women with me, you know, I saw him watching me and kind of keeping an eye on the women, and pretty soon he comes walking up with a camera and he says, what are you guys doing here? You know, and I'm like, wouldn't you like to know? You know, and I had already warned the ladies that they didn't have to interview if they didn't want to, and he was very respectful of that. Several did choose to interview with him, which is significant because up until this point, many plural wives were not willing to go public. However, by writing their experiences in our book, they felt a freedom and a joy in revealing their feelings to the public that they haven't had a chance to have before. And they wanted to be there, as much to speak for themselves as to support each other for this opportunity. So we did have interspersed between talking to the legislators of the Judiciary Committee. We also spoke to Rod Decker on camera. And
tell him what he said on the Capitol.
Yes. We had an invitation from him to go live at noon. But before we got to that, actually, and I will get to that, Senator Ron Allen's intern came out and asked me if we would come into his office and speak with him. And I said, you bet. He's the sponsor of the bill. I definitely wanted to speak with him. We were invited into his office, and as the ladies filtered into his office, I could see the look on his face going from smug to shock. He didn't realize how many women were there. No one told him. In fact, to this day, I do not know who told him we were there lobbying against his bill. He was very patronizing, very arrogant, told us we didn't really know what we were talking about, even though we had studied the bill thoroughly and I could quote specific things in law to him. He said, oh, no, you don't have to worry. It's not our intention to remove children from polygamous homes. It's not our intention to prosecute parents who teach their children their beliefs. But then he insinuated that we were, in fact, guilty of being complicit in the crime of polygamy if we taught our children polygamous beliefs. So we could read between the lines through all this. Interestingly enough, he also invited in a sheriff because, you know, we're plural wives, so we're threatening to him by virtue of that fact. But there was a Salt Lake Tribune reporter who was also there, which we think was a benefit to us because every word he said was taken down. And later on, I had occasion to debate Ron Allen on this very bill, and I was able to quote back his words as they were quoted in the Salt Lake Tribune and were quoted in front of this witness. So he couldn't deny them. But after our meeting with Ron Allen, and which really didn't go anywhere because he just simply said that we didn't know what we were talking about, we met with Rod Decker on the Capitol steps, and he arranged us in this circle of women, and he wanted to stand in the middle. And the first comment he made when he went live was, no, we are not a family. And he got a real kick out of it. You know, he actually thought that was pretty exciting. And he leaned into me and he said, how did you find so many plural wives? You know, and I'm like, Rod, I had 100 in my book. We only had 11 there. I thought that was rather a small showing. However, the next day we had 11 more. All different women, and it was really exciting. But the real impact came Wednesday when we spoke in front of the Judiciary Committee and we testified to our feelings on this bill. We asked for two changes. We asked the words, let me see if I have it on my bill. We asked them to omit the words promote and encourage from the parental consent portion of the bill. And we asked them to clarify the portion of the bill that dealt with the officiators who performed commitment ceremonies, regardless of whether they were homosexual or polygamous ceremonies. We asked them to change that and omit any portion that dealt with consenting adults. We believe that consenting adults ought to be able to arrange their families as they see fit. We made that case before the Judiciary Committee. We got every change we asked for. It was very exciting because that day when we walked in, we were not expecting the show that we got with polygamous people. Several of the women who were there Monday and Tuesday called everyone they could think of and said, be there on Wednesday. We have to show our support. When we got there, we were thinking maybe 40 people would show up. The room continued to fill up, and I was just astonished. And when I went to testify, I knew there were almost 100 people there representing polygamous families. They said, in fact, the Judiciary Committee said they had never had such a large number of people show up on any bill ever. They were that amazed at that. They took our words to heart. And in fact, because we had talked to them individually one-on-one on Monday and Tuesday, they knew what our message was when we got there Wednesday. And we presented it in such a way that it was non-threatening. It was, in fact, we were very complimented that we were very well organized and that we had done a good job in relaying our opinions on it. Two representatives after the Judiciary Committee, they convened for Friday to come back and discuss the bill again. They went right back and pressed for the amendments we asked for. Friday morning, when we went in, we discovered that we had gotten what we asked for. It was a really tearful moment for me. The amazing thing is it went right over the heads of the press and most of the people there. Most of the public did not realize we had a change in the current law that was actually an improvement on current law on behalf of plural families. A lot of people didn't realize that. They kept saying, well, wait a minute, it's still illegal for an officiator to perform a polygamous ceremony. And I had to say, you know what? Under current law, it's a felony. Now it will be a misdemeanor. Yes, it's still illegal. Yes, we have more work to do. That is a huge difference in time of penalty, criminal penalty. But it was changed to a misdemeanor. That due in part to the work of Representative Scott Daniels, who is a Democrat, and Representative Catherine Bryson, who's a Republican. So this is very interesting because it didn't come down party line. It didn't come down whether they were Mormon or non-Mormon. We had the support of the Judiciary Committee behind us, and they made these amendments, and we had an improvement in law for the first time since laws were passed against polygamy. I do believe that is a historic event. It didn't get into the press that way, but we're still proud of the accomplishment, and we do feel that each little step is a milestone for the freedom rights, freedoms, and rights, civil rights of consenting adults. Of course, those close to our personal cause would be those consenting adults who choose to live plural marriage. Before I wrap this up, I just wanted to say quickly that one of the other things that I had occasion to do, which was an exciting experience, was debate Ron Allen. I was invited to do that. It was a little frightening to me. He's a senator, and I'm a mother of six beautiful children. And we debated in front of the Women's Legislative Caucus. And afterward, I had many of those women came up to me and said, you are right. He's not right. And we had Unitarian ministers. It was amazing, the broad range of people who supported our cause and the diverse backgrounds they were from. That was what we found most amazing. And we're not through yet. We know that. We realize that Ron Allen is not done. One of the things that came out after the session was over was an article by Greg Burton, a reference which I will read to you. From his article, it's called Proposal Grab Bag End Session, February 28, 2001. There's generally a grab bag of study issues there the legislators are supposed to study in between their sessions. And it says, more mysterious is a proposal to study whether involvement in a bigamist or polygamist relationship qualifies as harm or threatened harm under child protection laws used to order the removal of children from a home. Such language hearkens to the widely criticized 1950s raids by authorities in Arizona and Utah against polygamists. The harm done to some innocent families lingers today. House members agreed to remove the proposal from the master study list, but how the item made the list in the first place should cause some alarm. According to Senator Ron Allen of Stansbury Park, under whose name the study was requested, the proposal was never intended for interim study. Allen had looked at similar legislation at the request of an attorney for Tapestry Against Polygamy prior to the 2001 session. When a legislative attorney asked whether a bill should be drafted, Allen said no. The attorney decided, apparently wrongly, to send the proposed legislation to a pile of master study request forms. Allen never signed the form. It is not my intention to take children away from their families, Allen said. I find it interesting that after meeting with him in his office and debating with him and hearing him say, no, that is not my intention to prosecute parents for teaching polygamy, and no, this is not my intention, that these things still keep coming up in his bills or in his name. So I am of the inclination that, yes, I don't trust him. And I have no doubt that similar bills will come up in the next February session, and I hope that we can be prepared to meet them. Before I sit down, I wanted to read one final comment that I find a fantastic comment. And it's in this book, Polygamous Families in Contemporary Society, by the distinguished professor of psychology, Erwin Altman, and professor of anthropology, Joseph Gannat. This is a 5-year study on polygamous families. They found that polygamous families are quite normal, actually are very similar to monogamous families. They have similar family structures, problems, and challenges, as well as successes. They came to the following conclusion. In spite of the problems they face, some of these new forms of close relationships, including plural families among contemporary Mormon fundamentalists, are here to stay in American and Western society. They are not likely to go away. They are not fads or fancies. They are not aberrations. They will be part of the family life scene well into the future. We must therefore learn about them, learn from them, and even help people live the lifestyle of their choice. Doing so increases the probability that participants in emerging forms of close relationships will contribute to the well-being and equality of life in American society at large. Not doing so and viewing these family lifestyles as inherently immoral, wrong, and unacceptable increases the probability that American society will fragment with a declining sense of community and civility in our public and private lives. I realize that we are asking for tolerance and acceptance from people, and I realize in order to get it, we have to be willing to give it, and I'm willing to give it. Thank you very much.
I can't tell you what a thrill it's been to work with these two women. I already knew them quite well, I thought, before we started on this project, but I've always been a proponent of women bonding, and this was a real wonderful spiritual experience to work with both of them. We each had something different to bring to the table, and my particular expertise, I guess you might say, was the doctrinal part of the book. And not that I'm any expert on doctrine by any means, but I have helped my husband write over 60 books on LDS doctrine as it relates to the early teachings of the church. And it's been a real education to me for over 32 years to compile this information. And as I said the other night, there is a difference, and I am glad to be able to go back to those original doctrines and try the best I can to live those. Anyway, in beginning my paper, for several decades, media reporters seem to have taken delight in exploiting polygamous emergency room cases, describing the actions of a few who are certainly not representative of the thousands who espouse plural marriage as a religious principle. Joining with them have been three or four bitter and biased voices from Tapestry Against Polygamy who have expressed their strong opposition to this lifestyle. And, of course, in preparation for the 2002 Olympics, the LDS Church is even more emphatically denouncing the principle and clearly and understandably separating itself from those who continue the practice today. And in all the media report or interviews that we have had ever since our book came out last December, we have been glad to make that distinction. We do not want the misconception to be out there that we are still members of the mainstream church and representing them in any way. This is a doctrine that has been discontinued in the church, and we point that out. Or at least the practice of it has been discontinued. Being exposed to only one side of the picture, the vast majority of Mormons and non-Mormons alike have developed a biased and inaccurate perception of the principle of plural marriage and of those who embrace it. This is because dedicated and well-adjusted polygamous family members continue to be hesitant in expressing themselves publicly, since there is a continuous risk of persecution if they do so. And I was perfectly happy 9 months ago to stay in the background and live my life quietly, but the three of us really felt like this is something we had to do, so we haven't regretted it, although there has been a certain price we've had to pay for coming out publicly. In spite of this threatening climate, however, a little over a year ago, three of us felt it was time to at least make this effort to balance the scales. The book Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage, is the result. That's this book. It's for sale at the Sunstone book table, if you're interested in getting that. It provided over 100 plural wives with an opportunity to anonymously express themselves on a subject that is of vital and eternal importance to them. In considering the publication of such a book, we three authors had feelings very similar to those expressed in a mass meeting of over 5,000 women in 1870 when they came to the defense of their plural marriage lifestyle in strong opposition to the federal anti-polygamy legislation. Sarah M. Kimball, president of this impressive assembly, spoke, quote, "But there is a point at which silence is no longer a virtue. Were we the stupid, degraded, and heartbroken beings that we have been represented, silence might better become us. But as women of God, women filling high and responsible positions, performing sacred duties, women who stand not as dictators, but as counselors to their husbands, and who in the purest, noblest sense of refined womanhood are truly their helpmates, we not only speak, because we have the right, but justice and humanity demand that we should. We too had reached the point," this is the end of the quote, "we too had reached the point where we felt silence was no longer a virtue. In our minds, justice and humanity demanded that we speak out in behalf of thousands of otherwise defenseless and but happily adjusted plural wives. Until this time, we have been very careful to avoid public recognition and to live our lives quietly and inconspicuously. Since the publication of our book on December 1st, 2000, the reverse has been the case. I'll skip over that because I have mentioned that. So we noticed in interviewing with the media, one of the most commonly asked questions was, why do women choose to live plural marriage? And I'm sure many of you have probably had that same question, because you have a stereotype perception that maybe they're under the rule of their husbands, or they don't get to magnify their talents or anything like that. And this is not necessarily the case. So in my paper, what I have done is I went through the book, and in every place where a woman gave a reason why she lived plural marriage or why she continued to stay in plural marriage, I jotted that down and I put it under subject headings. Did you pass out the handouts, Ken? He'll just pass out a synopsis of what I'm going to discuss. And what I'd like to do is discuss these 15 reasons and then give a very brief quote in a woman's words herself, so that you can tell the flavor of and the individuality of the women that are expressing themselves. The underlying or the major reason, the umbrella reason, why women that we're acquainted with and that answered to our questionnaire and to our book, the reason they live it, major, the main one, is a religious conviction. And then underneath that are three basic classifications: personal reasons, family reasons, and religious reasons. And a brief example of each one will be given or be read. In each one of those three major categories, there just happened to be that there were five individual ones. So starting with the first one, to increase personal and spiritual growth and fulfillment. And this is a quote in each case, and I'll try and hurry through these. But this principle puts my soul to the test, as it divides my carnal, selfish nature from my spiritual nature and makes me choose between them every day. Whichever nature I choose is strengthened, so I know that through the years this process will form me into a woman of pure, Christ-like love that I want to be. Okay, the second one is, I've got an unabridged edition here. To enjoy more freedom and develop independence. The independence we as wives have gained while living this principle has enabled two of us to achieve postgraduate degrees and professional careers. We are contemplating more than we ever dream possible, or accomplishing more than we ever dream possible. And this is the case in many of them, that after they begin to have a family or after they've had a family, they want to go back and continue their education. They have wives at home if it's agreeable with them, that they can be there with the children and provide a woman the opportunity of going to work or going back to school. Number three, to obey a personal revelation and or testimony. I could feel the Spirit of God, a joy and peace within that's almost indescribable. From that moment, I was given a true knowledge and testimony of the principle that I will never deny. This is the path to Godhead, my greatest goal. Number four, to experience the joy of close female companionship and bonding with sister wives. When I was first married, my husband had a first wife who was my best friend. Some people thought we were a little strange because we had so much fun together. What could be better than knowing that the people you love the most will be together with you in the same family for eternity? Number five, to realize true joy. I suppose most people think that living the principle has to be full of pain and heartache, but my experience has been the opposite. I've never been happier. These women are not just writing this to make it sound good. These are heartfelt expressions of how they feel. Okay, under family reasons, number six, to share family responsibilities. Quote, I am occasionally asked, if I had my life to live over, would I live plural marriage? The answer is absolutely. It has been wonderful for me and my children. I work outside the home and my sister wife doesn't. She cares for the house and helps with the kids. I in turn share my income with her, and this allows both of us to have our own spending money. It has been a blessing to never have to take my children to a daycare or to a stranger who has no love or concern for them. They see my sister wife as their second mother. Number seven, to provide the same blessings for her children that she experienced when growing up in a happy plural family. The first reason why I live plural marriage is that I grew up in a wonderful family that lived that law. As a child, I accepted it and as a wonderful way of life. The greatest gift my parents gave me was my brothers and sisters. To grow up in a family of 50 or 60 brings a greater joy than can be imagined. I have so many people to love me and so many people to love. I always have someone to turn to for love and support, no matter what the struggle. How could I help but want that same thing for my children? Number 8, to increase one's posterity and the circle of a loving family. There were over 50 children in our family, and most of them are now grown and married. Over the years, many of them have come to me as the first wife, asking how I really feel about plural marriage as I look back upon it all. There seems only one adequate answer for me. As I look at each of them, I feel compelled to admit that they alone have been ample reason and reward. Number 9, to give a woman more opinions to be sealed to a righteous man. What?
Options, not opinions.
Oh, options. Thank you very much. I stand corrected. Well, she has opinions, too. The reason the Lord gave us the opportunity to live celestial plural marriage is mainly because, in the eternal perspective, every one of Heavenly Father's daughters deserves to have the good man of her choice. And in this principle, a woman does not have to necessarily wait for a man to come knocking at the door and get down on his knees and propose. Naturally, it's a joint decision, hopefully, and it works the best. Definitely, the Lord is involved in the decision. But a woman does have the right to go to a man and his family and ask to be in the family. And then after it's discussed and they pray about it and they feel that this is the right thing, they can go ahead. Okay, number 10. To fulfill the requirement that for a marriage to be eternal, it has to be a celestial plural marriage. My journey in plural marriage began 19 years ago. I entered into celestial marriage in 1981 because of my desire to be with my spouse for eternity. Number 11, to better serve God. Oh, and then this is in the religious section now. To better serve God and obey His commandments. My father has 3 wives with whom I was taught to respect and love. My parents taught me that this way of life was a commandment of God. But when it came time for me to marry, I was free to choose for myself. Number 12, to bring us closer to God and instill a greater desire to become as He is. I believe one of the main purposes that we are commanded to live plural marriage is that it brings us closer to God. We find ourselves in situations that we don't know how to deal with alone. So He tells us, "Come unto me." And another quick one under that, it is a beautiful way to live in the way that God Himself lives. He has told us that we can be as He is, and in order to do that, we have to do as He has done. 13, to gain a greater appreciation and understanding of the life and sacrifice of the Savior and to follow His example. How else could I appreciate what the Savior did if I wasn't willing to sacrifice my whole soul to keep His commandment? We can say we believe, we can say we will do what the Lord asks, but until we actually do it, it's only words. Joseph Smith said that a religion that does not require the sacrifice of all things does not have the power to save you. In living this way, I have found that by losing myself, I have found myself. And 14, to live so as to gain greater eternal rewards and blessings. May our freedom to choose this higher way of life never be taken from us. For this is what will bring us eternal lives and blessings in heaven. And along with that, when others try to tell me what I was doing is wrong, I tell them that in the next life I want to be with those men and women who live the same way I do. I believe that Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Eliza R. Snow, and the Old Testament prophets all understand my heart, and so does God. And then the last one, number 15. To qualify for exaltation and the highest level of the celestial kingdom. I guess I didn't bring that book. I recently compiled 30 sources where the early leaders and scriptures say that in order to get to the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, you have to live celestial plural marriage. I didn't make this up. I just compiled it. But that's just what they say in these references. And this particular sister says, I have a testimony that the principle of celestial plural marriage is an essential way of being. It is the only way that we as immortal beings can bring our understanding and awareness to the point that we can be exalted to the highest degree in God's kingdom. I know this to be true and correct doctrine. Just a couple more things here in conclusion. Our purpose in writing this book, Voices in Harmony, and deciding to speak out publicly is not to justify what we consider to be an eternal law of God, to apologize for living it, or to convert others to such a lifestyle. Rather, it is to attempt to raise the level of understanding among non-polygamists, to provide an opportunity for contemporary plural wives to finally let their positive voices be heard, and to defend a doctrine we feel is both eternal and unchangeable. As in all cultures and lifestyles, there are those whose lives are less than perfect, and in the search for large audiences, the media tend to spotlight the most extreme nonconformists. Since the polygamous net catches all kinds of fish, we are disappointed by the instances when all those associated with plural marriage are painted with the same broad brush. In reality, there are many families beyond the public eye who have freely chosen to live plural marriage today and who do so honestly, morally, and valiantly with the hope of a greater eternal reward. Over 116 years later, our stand is the same as that of George Buchanan, who wrote the following in The Juvenile Instructor in 1885. Quote, a violent and vicious attack is being made upon the doctrine and practice of patriarchal plural marriage. Those who have practiced this principle are assailed with a ferocity never before known. Those who make the attack perhaps hope to drive the people of God to renounce the doctrine and promise not to obey the revelation. Vain and delusive hope. Unless the saints apostatize, such an action on their part is impossible. By doing so, they would deliberately shut the door of celestial glory in their own faces. They would say that by that action, quote, we do not have the valor necessary to sustain us in striving for the celestial glory, and we therefore are content to enter terrestrial or telestial glory. So intimately interwoven is this precious doctrine with the exaltation of men and women in the great hereafter that it cannot be given up without giving up at the same time all hope of immortal glory. This is George Buchanan. End of quote. So, paraphrasing Martin Luther's immortal words, here we stand as well. We take the same position as the early sisters in the 1870s, as George Buchanan and many of the other brethren. We stand on the belief that if the fullness of the gospel, including celestial plural marriages, live righteously, the wives will inherit the same celestial blessings as their husband, that they will stand side by side as kings and queens, priests and priestesses, and gods and goddesses. We stand on the conviction that this goal is worth sacrificing and striving for in this brief and temporal existence. As authors and compilers of Voices in Harmony, we are sincerely grateful to the 100 women, 95 of whom are or have been plural wives, who contributed to our book. And in conclusion, I quote from one more of them. We are not asking that all people enter into this way of life or even believe it. On the contrary, please live your monogamous relationships with honor. But let us bless one another and cut the warmongering among ourselves. If you choose not to play in the orchestra, that is just fine. But at least sit down and be quiet so others can play in or listen to the symphony. And that is our request as well. Thank you.
Even though fundamentalists don't like to be stereotyped and painted with a broad brush, I think that most of us would easily and readily admit that we're a strange lot. And that we have, like many groups in America, our own little metaphors, our own particular set of language. And, for example, fundamentalists don't have midlife crises near as much as they have midwife crises. You know, when a man has two wives and both of them are in labor and there's only one midwife, that's a midwife crisis. And then there's midwives crises when a man is in his car on the way to keep a date with one wife and the other one calls him up on his cell phone and says, I need to talk to you right now. That is a midwife's crisis. But I have to really hand it to Sunstone. When we went to MHA, Mary and I and Anne were listed in the program not with our credentials, not with anything else, just plural wife and author of Voices in Harmony. And I had commented on that, and the Salt Lake Tribune reporter that was there was very careful in the Tribune report to note us as presenters And you'll notice that Sunstone has had that same respect. I think we're setting a new trend. On a more serious note, I'd like to tell you that my heritage in plural marriage has extended without cessation for 6 generations on one line and 5 generations on the other. Some of my family were introduced to plural marriage in Nauvoo. My great-great-great-aunt lived kitty-corner to the mansion house. She was one of the women who was entrusted to teach other women, instructed by Joseph Smith, to teach other women about the principle. And on delivered proposals on his behalf. My great-great-grandfather was in the first presidency's office 2 days before the manifesto and was instructed to go to Mexico so that he could live plural marriage. And then he sat in conference and heard the manifesto presented. I do have a sense of this continuity that is unbroken, and I find very little difference in the expression and the religious beliefs of my family, of those that lived it before the manifesto and those that have continued to live it since. The only difference has been the degree of acceptance or rejection from the LDS Church. And with that, I'll begin my paper. In the fall of 1999, the Salt Lake Tribune reported that a Utah lawmaker had suggested that, quote, it is time to make peace. It is time for Utah to make peace with its peculiar past by issuing official state apology to polygamists for anti-bigamy law enforcement raids in the 1940s and 1950s. The same week, both a Tribune editorial and a Tribune editorial cartoon responded. The cartoon depicted two legislators in conversation. Don't you think Utah should apologize for the raid on Short Creek, says the first. And the other answers, you mean where Arizona officials arrested Arizona polygamists in an Arizona town 46 years ago? In a similar twist, the editorial stated, the state of Utah does not owe polygamous families or descendants of polygamous families an apology for the raid on Short Creek nearly 50 years ago. As a fundamentalist Mormon, those two omissions caught my attention. Both the cartoon and the editorial had omitted the lawmaker's reference to the Utah's role in polygamy, in its role in the polygamy raid of 1940s and its role in 1950s. Was this deliberate, or was it just ignorance? Now, it is highly probable that few among the general public are aware of facts regarding the polygamy raids of the 1940s and 50s, but Utah journalists should not be so naive. Utah newspaper headlines on 7 March 1944 are clear that Utah was completely responsible for a major polygamist raid in 1944 and proud of it. And perhaps it is true that Utah was not officially involved in the 1953 raid on Short Creek in Arizona. According to Utah Governor J. Bracken Lee, quote, we got the dickens beat out of us by the press and everyone else with the 44 raids. It simply was not worth it, unquote. However, in 1954, Utah did initiate the highly publicized Vera Black case, which Ken Driggs did his LLM thesis on, involving the children of a polygamous wife from Hilldale, the Utah side of Short Creek, Arizona. This was a test case to determine the feasibility of forcibly taking children from polygamous families on the basis of polygamy alone. Therefore, the cartoon and the editorial selectively ignored pertinent facts and thus wrongfully insinuated complete innocence of Utah involvement in efforts taken against polygamists. This is just one example of misinformation that has added fuel to the fire of recent public outrage against polygamy. According to propaganda definitions, this type of misinformation falls into the category of propaganda, defined to mean, quote, the dissemination of information for the purpose of persuasion and advocating agenda, unquote. In the recent resurrection of century-old rhetoric against polygamy, the agenda has seemed as obvious as ever, to portray polygamy, that polygamy is bad, that it is an embarrassment to the state of Utah, and that anyone, like the legislator who dared suggest another side of the story, is likewise an embarrassment and a fool. Information twisted or incomplete becomes misinformation, and misinformation is dangerous because it is a form of blatant lying. According to one source describing such templates of media propaganda, misinformation often works this way. An incorrect or incomplete story is run about an issue or a person. The misinformation establishes the desired sentiment in the mind of the audience. The effect is emotional momentum. Once the sentiment associated with the lie is infused in the mind of the audience, it attains a sort of emotional momentum such that counter-reasoning or facts will not change the infused sentiment. Emotional momentum is attained, and retractions do nothing to undo the original sentiment associated with the incorrect story. If necessary, a retraction may be printed days or even weeks or months later in the back of the newspaper. But, quote, even if or though a retraction is printed, it is usually done in such a way as not to be noticed by the average audience, and the retraction does little to undo the harm it has caused, unquote. In Utah, polygamy generally evokes emotional momentum. Misinformation, to put it mildly, is like throwing gasoline on a fire. In the recent past, a major source for gasoline, if you'll pardon the analogy, has been media reports that have woven the presence and opinion of the anti-polygamy organization Tapestry against polygamy into nearly every polygamy-related article. For a period of time, media coverage presented Tapestry opinion as the expert, the authority, and the legitimate voice regarding all polygamy issues. Unfortunately, especially from a fundamentalist perspective, this organization has been a continual source of misinformation and has become adept at using emotional momentum from misinformation to further its cause. As a result, an out-of-balance perspective has become prevalent that has portrayed all polygamy as inherently evil and abusive. Such sentiment culminated into ethnic cleansing language when Tapestry explicitly urged that, quote, all polygamist wives should be forced to be deprogrammed, unquote. And to its mission statement added an agenda to, quote, end polygamy permanently, unquote. Such expressions helped fuel a fire against polygamists so heated that any attempt by fundamentalist Mormons to give another perspective was sure to result in such individuals becoming immediate targets themselves for hostility and suspicion. This applied equally to any family, friends, or others, including legislators, who dared speak in defense of polygamists for any reason. Of course, no one, especially fundamentalist Mormons, ever expected a retraction by the Tribune for the misinformation published in the cartoon or editorial, any more than they expect an apology from the state of Utah for the 44 raid. Such an apology would be just as unlikely as the U.S. government offering redress for its raids against Utah polygamists in the 1880s. Nevertheless, misinformation has not been the exception to the rule regarding media coverage about polygamy in Utah. Rather, misinformation typifies much of the recent media coverage. To its credit, the Salt Lake Tribune finally initiated more balanced reporting when it began to publish a few articles by professionals and academics with inside knowledge about polygamists in Utah, their communities, and their beliefs. And what most people don't know is that this came about as a result of some of these academics getting together and say something has to be done, and they approached the editorial board of the Tribune, who listened and began publishing some other articles. However, these points of view that cast polygamy in a more favorable light, or at least in a non-threatening light, and as a viable family structure, did not and have not received the same repetitious and preferential treatment given the Tapestry point of view. Frankly, newspapers and other media outlets are businesses, and these points of view simply don't sell nearly as well. Polygamy coverage, especially when it has been accompanied by a deluge of misinformation, has tended to stereotype all fundamentalists. Most fundamentalist Mormons are annoyed and more often repulsed to the level at which public discussion about polygamy often descends. One aspect of such discussion became painfully obvious. There has been an absence of the voices of fundamentalist Mormons themselves, aside from Tom Green, especially women. Voices in Harmony was written in part to help fill that void, as well as to raise the level of discussion about polygamy. It has been delightfully surprising that some reporters have listened respectfully to us and published articles that we feel were genuinely fair. It has been, however, discouraging when other media personnel, some even with respectable reputations, have been determined to engage us in low-level, prurient, even salacious conversation about polygamy. Questions asked of polygamist wives, we noted, were often worded in ways that would be considered insulting and demeaning to women in any other arena. It has been our challenge, both in writing Voices in Harmony and in meeting with media, to answer natural and genuine questions in ways that convey respectful understanding while maintaining dignity for ourselves and the principle which we consider sacred. In a hostile climate, the task of opening meaningful dialogue and raising the level of discussion has often seemed daunting. Nevertheless, we have found some effective tools. Respond to venues for discussion that foster mutual respect. Interact openly and positively. Refuse to engage in salacious dialogue. And avoid forum which is predictably tawdry. Expose the fallacy of stereotypes. Look for ways in which to more effectively convey understanding. In most cases, the result have been a respectful and meaningful exchange. It is gratifying to know that our book is being read not only by many officials, legislators, and interested persons within Utah, but that our message is also being considered outside Utah by people in other states as well as in other countries. We have received numerous emails, including, of course, a few hate messages. Most, however, have been positive and supportive. Here is one from Kent, Washington. I saw your article in the news and followed the link to your site. I have no experience with pro-marriage lifestyle, but want to write a note of support. There is so much fear and prejudice out there. This will not be an easy path for you, but I strongly felt when I read your excerpts that what you are saying is very important somehow in the overall scheme of things. And here's one of my favorite from somewhere in Arizona. I am an ex-Mormon, fifth generation. Both of my great-grandfathers practiced polygamy. Mariner W. Merrill, an apostle and the president of the Logan Temple, was one of them. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to do what you have done, and though I don't agree with some of your views, I am impressed with the rational, logical, and honest way you expressed yourself. I do not think polygamy should be illegal, nor is it immoral. The argument is usually made that it abuses women, children, etc., and usually freakish stories are promoted whenever the topic is discussed. My question to them, since women and children are abused in monogamous marriages, why not abolish them as well? I commend you on a very well-written book and hope that the politicians and the law enforcement of Utah will stop wasting time and money attacking polygamists and focus on those who are truly victims. And this is my favorite one of all. As a Smith from the original root, descendant of wife number three of Jesse Nathaniel Smith, and a leader in the church today, I privately pray for your success and feel that you are performing a pioneering effort that few have courage to undertake. History will probably praise your efforts to win true religious freedom. in a country where most freedoms have already evaporated due to neglect. God bless you. Opening a dialogue and raising the level of discussion was the purpose for which Voices in Harmony was written and continues to be among our most important and most challenging goals. It is apparent that this small seed planted in faith is beginning to bear fruit when a congressman in Washington, D.C. says, "It is about time someone wrote a book like this, giving another side of the story." Thank you.
I guess we should open the floor for questions at this point if you want to direct them to this generally or to individuals. Why don't we start and move across the room over here?
Thank you. I want to congratulate you on your very fine book. I say that not fundamentally going to the Mormons either, but as an anthropologist who studies families in Asia, I know that the religion is well or historically long-standing. That's not my question. My question for
does
you
he need
is,
to come to a mic?
Yeah, I'm going to repeat it into the microphone.
Part of your argument is based on the success of the family systems in creating harmony. The same argument, of course, is based on those who advocate partnership or marriage arrangements between the gay and lesbian communities. One thinks of cases in New Hampshire, California, most recently in Denmark, and it gets to the point. Have those groups sought politically alliance?
I think the short version of the question for the tape would be, have any of y'all sought alliances with individuals who are interested in the legalization of same-sex marriages?
Okay, I can answer that. Actually, we've been in contact with the ACLU and have actually, that question obviously has come up. There's obviously some, they're not particularly interested in aligning with us, and I think the majority of fundamentalist Mormons would not be interested in aligning with them at this point, although I think that both sides recognize that in the civil context there's very similar issues. And I think that we're still in a stage where we're really evolving our opinions of each other and what it really means to be a family as much as the rest of society is. But we don't have violent feelings toward each other or anything. In other words, I think we're kind of looking back at each other and kind of going, where really do you stand? So I would say the answer to the question is it's evolving. And we don't really know.
And I'd like to add to that that there's a real distinction between civil rights and what we feel are religious rights. Civilly, I think we both have a similar claim, a similar goal to be accepted. We do not want plural marriage legalized. We would like it decriminalized, which means just take it off the books so that if somebody has a job or a rental, that they aren't going to fear losing that just because of their lifestyle. Now, if there's a crime committed, that's a totally separate thing, and that should be handled. But the distinction is the civil handling of it and the religious aspect.
I might make one added comment to that. There is a 1991 Utah Supreme Court decision in the matter of WAT. If anybody's interested, I can give you the citation to it. It was an adoption petition by a polygamous family in southern Utah. I was very involved in that case. I was not one of the attorneys of record, but I was very much assisting people down there. It fell right in the area of my LLM thesis. And the ACLU filed an amicus brief on our behalf, and I did some go-between between the Colorado City people and the ACLU. I know through some other contacts I have that there has been sometimes some considerable internal debate at the national ACLU about involvement with this community. There are some pretty strongly held views on both sides. There clearly is a legal connection between acceptance of one type of non-traditional family and another, and any legal developments that advance the rights of one has an obvious impact on the other community.
I actually, just to add a comment here, I actually gave a speech at a Freedom of Religion rally a couple of months back, and one of the comments I made was, toleration means nothing if we only tolerate those people with whom we agree.
Another question here, if you would.
I have two questions for all three of the ladies. Realizing that you mentioned that some of the marriages dissolved, what would you see as maybe the first two aspects that cause a polygamous marriage to dissolve? And the other question is, what are the two hardest issues within the marriage that you all have to live?
For purposes of the tape, the question is, can you address some of the issues that create dissolution in polygamous marriages? What are the problem areas?
I think there's probably as many reasons for a dissolution of a plural marriage as there are dissolutions of a monogamous marriage. Finances, incompatibility. I think in many cases, but not all, there is jealousy. That is one thing that women realize is a possibility in a marriage before they go into it. And if they are not strong enough to be able to handle that, then they probably shouldn't get into it to begin with. And usually women can get above that, especially maybe in time. I was lucky. I had one day, and that was it. And I feel very lucky because I think that I experienced that so I could relate to how other women feel. So I would answer that very broadly. I don't think there's any particular finances are always a problem in a large family. And a mixture of children. If you live too close together, like turkeys, it's very hard to, if you're very confined, without pecking on each other. So a lot of times people choose to live with their families separate in different homes. Jacob had many tents, so I think he must have had family in each one. What? Yeah, do you want to add that?
Well, there's
prioritizing you. If you, from a superficial standpoint, if you felt finances or closeness.
It's very difficult to prioritize because everybody's experience is different, and I've also observed that the dynamics of a plural family changes dramatically about every 5 years. What this family is like, especially if it continues to add wives, it changes. And it's so different in 5 years that it's difficult to say. Women go through different things, but I think that one of the main breakdowns that comes down is when the breakdown comes between a husband and a wife. She can go through a lot of things, but if she cannot maintain or they cannot maintain a dyadic relationship that is significant and meaningful, and Dr. Altman and Dr. Gannat spoke at length on this, showing that in successful families, the women will bond together and see to it that a man protects each dyadic relationship. In other words, if he doesn't take care of that relationship, he may one day not take care of ours. And so they will see to it that he is fair. They will see to it that if he's getting neglectful and there's ongoing problems between the two of them, they put some peer pressure on him. And when that breaks down, quite often, but that's because the dynamics of a plural family are small. They're individual marriages that form a complete family unit, a whole family unit. It is not Tom. It's not Jane and Mary and Tom married. It's Mary and Tom and Jane and Tom that are married. Each one has their own relationship. Does that help?
You've got to get rid of cups.
I agree. I think that if the individual marriage between one woman and the husband starts to have problems that do not get addressed and they grow, then the foundation of their personal marriage becomes difficult for her to withstand the things she sees with him and the other women. See, if their marriage is strong, they can generally withstand whatever challenges come. So I think that is probably the number one reason.
I might add a personal observation. I've been involved with the fundamentalist community, various places of it, 12 or 13 years now, and I've been in a lot of homes. I have a lot of friends. And I think I, like a lot of people, started off with their stereotype of the women as not being very assertive, perhaps being very much dominated by their man. That is not what you see. Absolutely, I have found women in the fundamentalist community to be, as a group, much stronger personalities than I found sort of in the outside world. And when you think about it, that makes a lot of sense. Because they are going very much against the grain. And I think it takes a strong personality to choose to do this and go into it. And so now I'm not really surprised when I find very strong personalities, but you really see that. Yes, ma'am.
I understand that you're all reared in polygamy, but it seems like a natural thing.
We didn't know. We were not.
No, she was.
I'm the only one. Oh, okay. Let me ask you then. This is the question. Is my people were all witness to that too, and I was wondering what percentage of the people going into plural marriage for the first time in their family with no history in the background. Do you have any statistics or knowledge about that?
I don't remember the number.
The question is for the tape: is what percentage of people grew up in plural marriages?
Of the 100 women that participated in our survey, more or less, some of them didn't answer all the questions, and you know it was a little bit skewed that way. We were surprised that the high number of women who came from other states. The majority all became Mormon first. You just don't hardly find women that come from other religions without becoming a Mormon first. That doesn't happen. And the only case that I know of that it did, the marriage broke up and she didn't stay because she just didn't have the foundation. But the older women, of the 50 older women that participated, and about 50% in our book were older women, half of them were not raised in plural marriage.
Half. Can I just ask where I think, and in my family's background, the wives became doctors and so on, and the Brigham Young sent them back to medical school. And actually, he sent their husband on missions for 20 years, and they supported him his whole life. I was wondering what the tendency is now for the wives to be supporting the husbands as, or vice versa?
You know, that's such a broad question. Every family is different. But in my experience, the men work very hard. But they can't always meet all the needs. And so in a family that works, it's sort of what do we need to do to make it work? We do what it takes to make it work because we're so committed to this.
Question in the back. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, in many cases, one or two of the wives do work, especially if they're going to all live in, or like two or three wives live in the same home, where somebody's home with the kids and one goes out. And so many times you have more than a one-income family. There was something else I was going to say. Anyway, go ahead, Todd.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't consider it a group. Independent Fundamentalist Mormon.
First, I'm an independent fundamentalist Mormon. I wasn't necessarily raised that way, but I am now. And I do want to add that to Anne's comment. It's kind of funny, when we started doing interviews, a lot of people thought that independents were also a group. So we have to make the distinction that we're not, and what that means, we're just like any other person of any other religion who maybe doesn't go to church. We don't really have an organized church or organized body that we associate with. Then Marianne did, and I wasn't at the panel, so I can't comment because I don't know what he said.
My background is that my family has been, I've been associated with the LRED group all my life. I was born, raised, come from that heritage and background, and it was a tremendous support system. I can't even begin to tell you what that was like in terms of just, it's probably like what a lot of people experienced earlier before they did the correlation and the meeting, where the wards worked really closely together. They became very bonded as they built their ward houses and stuff. It's just a very large community, but you're also very interrelated. It was a very good experience, I was very happy in it.
Just for the record, I was born and raised in the LDS Church. Graduated from BYU, was married in the temple for my first marriage, which lasted 9 years, and then I've been in a plural marriage for nearly 33 years. The question you had about the groups, I think the biggest, it's not really a complaint, but the biggest thing that we feel is maybe hard for other people to understand is the claim of authority that has existed in the groups, whether they're big or small. There's one man that rises to the top through whatever method that might be, and then is like the president of the church. He might have counselors. He might have a quorum that assists him in that calling. It varies. But as far as independent fundamentalist Mormons are concerned, ordinarily they feel like the church is still the only true church, that it is out of order and will be set in order, and that it is incorrect to form another church. I know a lot of times these groups are important because, like Marianne said, you gain strength and security and companionship, and it's good to raise your kids with other kids that believe the same way. So there's a lot of benefits that come from these groups. But we personally, Marianne pretty much now and the two of us, even though we don't have a particular meeting we go to every Sunday all together, we get with our family or different families and have study groups or sacrament or whatever, whichever way we feel is the best.
One last comment with regard to that is that I was raised like Anne. I mean, you know, I don't have any a different belief in the fact that I believe absolutely that the church is the church, and we find ourselves in a situation where we are not to form another church. We know we feel this kind of out there, this feeling of being out there, not really belonging anywhere. But it's not because we believe that we should form another church. That is different in among most all the other groups. But that is not the belief that I was raised with, was that the church is the church.
If I might comment on that a little bit. If you're interested, I just published a pretty lengthy history of Colorado City. The first part of the article has some discussion of the various groups in the winter 2001 issue of the Journal of Church and State. My name is Ken Driggs. The article is, "This Will Someday Be the Head and Not the Tail of the Church, A History of the Mormon Fundamentalists at Short Creek." It's a quick run through their history. And I probably have as much contact with Short Creek, I suppose, as anybody here. It's been my understanding that the All Red group sees themselves as a priesthood quorum, a special priesthood quorum within the umbrella of the church. And Marianne can certainly correct me if I've got that wrong. Colorado City has moved a little further out, and they've actually incorporated themselves as a legal entity called the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And as I understand the groups, they are sort of the furthest out of the Mormon umbrella. And they're a much more authoritarian community, although I personally think that most of the bad stuff you hear about them is just patently untrue. I have a lot of friends down there, and I just don't see all the nightmares down there when I go visit. Yes, you.
I understand Joseph Smith's factors for it. I question that this is ever a command, and I'm wondering if where do you cite the fact that
well,
your whole you cooked up to the fact that it was a revelation.
Right.
And you're going on that, that's your basic foundation. If that were not available, your reason for practicing polygamy would be for some other reason.
The question for the tape, purposes of the tape, is what? How do you? Where do you find the authority for this as a religious belief, even though Joseph Smith may have actually practiced it?
We actually address that in the book. We have a chapter, as part of our overview chapter, we have a section where we quote from the early leaders of the church, as well as DNC 132, which is a revelation that we believe is still an accepted revelation to the LDS church. No one's ever come out and said that is not a revelation. But it's very clear from the early speeches of the early leaders of the church that the everlasting covenant was synonymous with plural marriage, and that definitions have changed over the years as after the manifesto came out. But Anne can address that better. She's also done a compilation on exactly that subject.
Section 131 is almost as important as Section 132, and let me just quote briefly from that. "In the celestial glory, there are three heavens or degrees, and in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of priesthood, meaning the new and everlasting covenant of marriage," and I'll explain that in a second. If he does not, he cannot obtain it. He may enter into the other, but that is the end of his kingdom. He cannot have an increase. At the time that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were talking about plural marriage, they used different terms than we do today. They used, in order to mean plural marriage, they used celestial marriage, patriarchal marriage, new and everlasting covenant of marriage. They all meant plural marriage. Today, celestial marriage just means you go to the temple and are married to one person for eternity. At least it's conditional, but that's the promise if you live righteously. So I think between 131 and 132 and just many of the early leaders' quotes on how important that was, that's where we get our scriptural and spiritual basis other than our own personal testimonies.
Well, those are pretty strong. There are some of the historians have addressed this issue and have published, as usually as a part of other discussions, how the terminology changed, usually in the 1920s. But it was in the period of Mormon in transition between 1890 and 1930, when the transition of the meanings, the definitions, became different.
Question in the back. It's a three-part question. Why didn't Adam have more than one wife? Why was not plurality of wives an aspect of the experience after the flood with Noah? And you reference the Book of Commandments making reference to monogamous marriage.
I'll take the first one. Regarding Adam, Brigham Young said in Journal of Discourses, Volume 1, page 50, and that Adam brought one of his wives with him. Isn't that the correct reference on that? We believe that gods do live plural marriage. And so he brought one of his wives with him to start the ball rolling down here, and now we're getting into another doctrine I don't want to even approach. But in answer to that question, we do feel that Adam did have more than one wife, but he only brought one down here on mortality.
That was exactly what I was going to say. I was just going to explain that fundamentalist Mormonism is actually a very broad religion, and it's not just polygamy. It encompasses a lot of theology, a lot of different doctrines, including this one that she is speaking of, taught by Brigham Young, very clearly by Brigham Young. And we do believe that Adam had other wives. He just may not have had them here. Now, that's the other part of the question.
Ogden, you want to do Noah?
Actually, Ogden probably could do it, but I can say that we have to keep in mind that there were also not just pairs of animals, the clean animals, there were seven. Seven pairs. And I'll let Ogden, if he wants to answer the question on Noah. But pertaining to your question about the Book of Commandments, there is an excellent article written, I believe, by Richard Van Wagner on Mormon polyandry that was published several years ago. And he addresses very thoroughly the discussion about what happened in church history addressing that very issue and how it came across. And I just recommend that to you because I don't think that there's any way that we can go into that here.
Ma'am, one more. We have about 10 more minutes for questions.
Can he just answer about Noah so she gets her question answered?
Well, there isn't too much on it, except I heard a lecture one time by a fellow who was a professor of the study of animals, whatever. And he said the only way that he could get so many animals on the ark is to bring them all in when they were babies.
What about him living through America and keeping it alive?
Well, there's a lot of things in the Old Testament they didn't give all of the details on. We're finding a lot of new material in some of the records that are being found. That we're finding libraries over in the Far East. But For instance, there's like with Moses. With Moses, who gave a lot of laws, and a lot of them were on marriage. There are six laws that I know of in the law of Moses that either gave permission or recognized or commanded people to live plural marriage. So we don't get all of it through all of the other prophets.
One.
We've got two questions
here.
On the monogamy
issue. Keep an eye on your time.
Okay. Joseph F. Smith said in July 1878, the marriage of one woman to a man for time and eternity by the sealing power, according to the law of God, is a fulfillment of the celestial law of marriage in part. But this is only the beginning of the law, not the whole of it. And it goes on. It's a very interesting statement because it says that he will be blessed to the extent he lives the law, but he can only receive a fullness of the blessing if he lives plural marriage.
Celestial.
All right.
What?
Second anointing has nothing to do with plural marriage. It's a totally separate ordinance.
Well, I know, but my grandmother dead, my grandfather died, and the only dead women that completely was banished so that she could get the second anointing to go to the celestial kingdom.
Well, in those days, you were supposed to live plural marriage before you received your second anointing because that was almost a requirement.
But he being married to two dead women.
I can't. Yeah, and that's probably true at that day. Of course, now you don't hear much at all about anybody getting their second anointings.
Why is that?
Well, there's probably several reasons for that. I don't know if we have time to go into that. I'll be glad to talk to you afterward.
Yes.
Gary, this guy's done.
Yes, question.
I use that explanation to explain to people the difference between our religious beliefs and our civil structure. Does that make sense? There's two different things, the civil language and the religious language, and I want people to understand that when I'm speaking politically, I'm talking about the civil language. That depends on what you feel a sacrifice means. I personally, you know, childbirth is difficult. Pregnancy is difficult. I think it's a sacrifice for a woman on her body, on the effort she puts into a pregnancy to bring forth a child. But the reward is incredible when you bring that child into the world and you hold that child for the first time. And it's something that a woman understands after she's had a baby. In that sense, there are things that you have to do. There's labors that you perform. There are things that you give up or you share or whatever that not necessarily are going to kill you, but, you know, you are willing to make them because you know the benefits and the joys that come are rewarding.
Marianne. Just a comment along that line is that my experience is that living this way has brought me to a greater understanding of the atonement than and other people, and I've also had that same expression from other women.
One last question, please, on Holy Andrew. Is there a doctrine, I'm not familiar with this, but is there a notion, or do you talk about it, speculation, never been speculated, that Holy Andrew is also a form of plural marriage, which we find by that might work?
Well, it's also a form of plural marriage with multiple spouses by broad definition, but it is not something we adhere to at all. It's just the opposite.
Although Todd Compton might disagree.
I don't think so.
Yes, another question. Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, real quick. This is a mystical question. I think it's important, though. David Levitt, Ron Allen, Scott Howell, Doug White, Ron Barton, Heber J. Grant, J. Reuben Clark, Mark E. Peterson, and Gordon B. Hinckley. These men have all dedicated big chunks of their lives to crush polygamy. And, you know, the unutterable name of God, Yahweh, or YHVH, is sometimes said to mean man, woman, covenant, woman. So it's polygamy is almost found in the very name of God. So what is it with these men? What is it that's so darn radioactive? What's so toxic? What makes these people hate? What is it that makes them want to spend their whole lives being so hell-bent and crush this filthy, stinking practice?
I think that the best person to answer that is Michael Quinn. If you were in my paper yesterday, you would have heard him talk about Heber J. Grant and why he in particular was so vehement against plural marriage, and it boiled down to personal reasons. He was turned down for several wives, never had a son that lived to adulthood. Said at one point in time, I'm going to keep marrying in plural marriage till I get a son that will actually live. The bottom line, he actually performed two plural marriages, according to Michael Quinn, in 1897 in Mexico under the direction of someone that was his senior, and later just came to just throw it all away, and it was a very personal vendetta.
Any other questions?
In answer to that, too, we do not make any negative attacks against the church or the people in it. We're trying to raise the level of understanding. We're trying to present positive and educational information, and Gary can answer that just as well as anybody.
I don't know why this one. I don't understand.
We have one more question in the back.
I've known about it lately all my life. His father.
The comment is asking if anybody has any response on the fact that Hilldale, Utah, which is a polygamous community, has the highest public assistance benefits in the state.
Do you want to answer?
Well, I mean, I've seen those figures. My reaction to that is, while I understand that there's certainly a public relations.